Hello, patrons. How's it going? Postgame 52, a year of postgames.
Hell yeah, man. It's been a lot of fun.
It has.
And we're staring down the barrel of another winter storm here. I mean,
yeah,
not much has changed.
Right back where we started. Except there's Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah, there's Bitcoin.
Guys on the case now, so I'm sure
that'll solve all the problems. Oh, yeah, I forgot about those guys. There's Bitcoin guys on the case. There's more bored monkeys.
There's,
what
you know,
could you want?
More folks have moved, more tech folks probably in Austin than there was.
Trump's off Twitter. Was that before? I can't remember when they did that to him.
It
was January
6th.
This
is Jan 6th.
January
6th. Yeah. How could you forget, obviously?
The darkest day.
Been in the darkness since.
Well, welcome, everybody. Remember, we have the number. I can read it out. Why not read it to folks?
Yeah.
Can I do it in time? I'm not on my Twitter account, but let's see. I want to get our phone number so we can get some more voicemails from folks. So you got to talk to Bender. Bender has got the technology to take calls, Matt.
I know. It's very complicated.
Let me see. We got our phone number right here. Oh, Lord in heaven.
Well, while... I think I should be able to have it too.
It's 1-940-289-7234.
So there you go.
Give us a call, leave a voicemail, and we will play it later in the show.
Let's knock one out right now just to dip our feet.
Good.
How about that? So we'll just start from the very beginning of the ones we got today. This is a 46 second one here, so that should be safe. I'll bring it up right now. Okay.
Hey, David, Matt, and possibly other Matt. This is Paul from South Dakota, better known as Seb Gorka's Back Pain. I just was wondering, I have a question related to tonight's show. Who do you think is the most cringiest celebrity endorsement of crypto or NFTs? And who do you think is the next celebrity to endorse crypto or NFTs? I think the cringiest is, because I love movies, I just absolutely cannot stand every time I go to the movies, it plays in front of the trailers, the Matt Damon crypto ad.
Yeah.
And I think the next celebrity, based on how insane she's gotten for her House of Gucci promo, I think Lady Gaga is getting into NFTs. All right. Ooh. Thanks. Bye.
Interesting. So it's hard, like, what is the most cringe is interesting to define, because to me it's like, it could be like, is it somebody you respect doing it? And that's like, damn. Because like, I like Matt Damon. It doesn't break my heart. Like, I like the Bourne movies, but like, I'm not like, God, not, we just lost Matt
not,
Damon.
They got Damon. They got Damon. We've lost the country.
But who would, I mean, really, like, it's tough to beat the pair of Fallon and Paris.
I was going to say the same thing. I mean, that was just, could you see two people less actually excited about this process?
I got my ape and it's, oh my God. It's, I mean, that is definitely.
Gwyneth,
like,
Paltrow's got one, right?
Gwyneth Paltrow. I mean, the Reese Witherspoon one where she's like, we're trying to make this about like a feminist for crypto.
That's
like,
pretty
that's
embarrassing.
Just, that's very cringeworthy.
That might be the worst, because like, it's something to be like, to sort of, I don't know, degrade yourself a little bit in front of a camera and be like, I love my JPEG that I don't even actually own. I love my link to a JPEG that somebody else owns that I have. But to sit there and be like, this is a problem in American society and in global society, is that there's not enough women in NFT scams out there.
Yeah, there's
I
not
think
enough
that's
women.
Probably as bad as it gets.
Yeah, there's not enough women doing the thing that's going to make me a lot of money just because I'm Reese Witherspoon, and like a certain number of people, like that's you know, interesting to them to have some sort of celebrity.
Oh, dude! You know what? Can we go to our favorite website? We did this a while ago. Excuse me, one second. Pop Crush.
Remind me, this sounds familiar, but I'm forgetting what it was.
Oh, never mind. I'm getting confused with another website. Remember there's a website we did a while ago that was like celebrity opinions or something like that? And it was like some guy like like really coming up with like, if you know, you type in a celebrity, it's like, are they a Republican or a Democrat? And just like the most wild categories, and this person has like, well, he said that he loves to eat meat, so he's probably a Republican.
Oh my god, yeah.
This is Pop Crush, so that's not it. I was just saying, let's see if there's something that we're forgetting. Celebrities, this is going to be a terrible website when it comes to pop-ups. Let me pull this up.
Seamus Welch as a Rammstein fan, seeing Till Lindemann
drive the Hawk NFTs.
That's I like Rammstein, yeah.
Everyone has been doing emails. What is this? Oh, this is 1999. Oh, is this going to be one of those where they... I love this. Are NFTs good?
Obviously, they can be good to invest in. Okay.
I love like dumbass shit like this. According to Wired. Anyway, celebrities who support NFTs. Paris Hilton supports NFTs. Oh, there's Lindsay Lohan on it.
Okay. All right.
Well, do you know who that is? Lime Payne?
Liam Payne? Is that... That's from that One Direction.
One Direction.
Popular for like 1 year, I feel like.
Oh, of course Grimes isn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, she thinks it can lead to communism.
Grimes is the saddest, I think, for a lot of people in our like neck of the woods. They really loved her.
I liked I mean, Oblivion's a great track.
Yeah. Bieber. Witherspoon. She's the social justice. Oh, yeah. A$AP Rocky.
Yeah.
Oh, this could go on for a while. But, oh, yeah. Lance Armstrong. That was a rough one, dude. That was a rough one for me. I like Lance Armstrong. I'm a Lance defender. I rode bicycles with Lance Armstrong because he's from Austin.
Oh, wow.
And he used to do like really, really sweet like after school programs because Austin's a great biking city. And like as part of like, I can't remember what it was, the Ride of the Rose or something like that. But at the end of it, if you rode so many miles, you got to go on this like nice bike ride with Lance Armstrong.
You know, that's interesting because I, on this, like, just to change topics a little bit, the steroid conversation, like, there's a lot of stuff going on with
baseball.
Major League Baseball. And I got to say, I'm over it. Like, all those fucking guys were roided up. Like, you can mention it in the Hall of Fame. Like, I think you should. But you should include those folks that like fucking slug like that. Like Barry Bonds, like I don't know. I don't even know if Barry Bonds is in or whatever, or if he's up. But like those sorts of questions. I mean,
all those guys.
Yeah.
That like whole generation of baseball when we were.
David Ortiz, you're going to keep him out of the fucking Hall of Fame. Go fuck your sports trash.
It's absurd. No, I mean, like, look, philosophically, I don't think like, because once you start having people like using performance enhancing drugs, like that, it puts people in a moral difficulty, I think, with everyone, like for everyone else in the sport, because like if some people are like using like steroids and they can compete at a different level because of that, you know, that sort of makes it so that like, well, if you want to compete, then you have to take it. Yeah, I think that's like, that's the argument that makes the most sense to me as to like why they should be banned. But also, like, come on, the moralism around it, I don't get. Like, again, I'm not saying that I don't think that it matters.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like, give me a break. These are some of like the most incredible athletes out there, and they would have been incredible without it. And yeah, if everyone else was doing it at the time, then I don't find like that to keep people like that out of the Hall of Fame. I think it's ridiculous at this
point. Yeah, you failed. You failed at policing that stuff. And like should have done a better job or something. I don't know.
Sorry. Like, in Lance's case, like he beat cancer, dude. And he's like going through like all this like horrible other stuff. He's beating cancer twice. I don't know. Juice a little bit. I think if you're like going through like a medical emergency, you would get like a pass.
I find Mark Cuban's arguments about that stuff persuasive. Like we should be in concertedly like formalizing research into this stuff and figuring out what is, you know, useful for making sure athletes stay healthy and like they can build strength and stuff like that in a safe way. Like I think it should it's legalization argument all over again.
Yeah. Matt and I are buying stuff at the gym now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, look at me. Here's one more voicemail before we get going with the first segment here.
Hey, fellas, how's it going? This is Gabe from Delaware, a.k.a. Brandon Town. Just wanted to touch base with you guys. It has been a while since a cancel culture spat has kind of been engaging to me, but I must say that following the Whoopi scandal in the wake of that video you guys did with Whoopi Hitchens and Bill Maher and the guy from Kiss a couple weeks ago really did sort of make this a fun time. At first, the line that some people were going with about how Whoopi was kind of, you know, getting stuck in, like, the American lens of like, race, that made sense to me. And then all of a sudden I had a flashback to her talking about how she lived in East Germany, and I was like, aha! And that was my gotcha moment with Whoopi. Anyways, love what you guys are doing. Hope to get some hot takes on this Whoopi fiasco. Not sure how I feel about the suspension. All right, bye guys.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't caught the whole thing. So she made a bad comparison about the Holocaust, essentially.
So, I mean, this is the problem, because I kind of didn't follow the story. But I have seen that, like, there are people questioning the, like, whether her. So, I can summarize it. She said the Holocaust was not about race. And then people come in with this, with the thing saying, like, well, Nazis say it's about race. Not the Nazis considered Jews to be a inferior race, right? So actually, it was about race. And I've seen criticism of from folks saying, like, why do you just accept the Nazi terms of this? Especially, like, you react to the scandal in a way that's like, okay, actually, like, Whoopi, the Nazis were right. Like, Jewish people are an entirely different race of people. Mm-hmm. That's fraught in American context because of what we already accept, like, think about, like, all the racism in this country, right? And so, like, I I'm open to people who have thought more deeply about, like, like these sorts of, like, the Holocaust questions, and but, like, I think there's something to that.
I just know that I can't imagine obviously why that would make people upset,
sensitive.
And I don't think it's outrageous for people to have a conversation about that, but I also know that, like, there are controversies around, like, you know, this is, like, something that is actively, like, debated, right? There are people who really want, like, Jewish people to be sort of recognized as, like, a race, particularly, like, people of, like, Eastern European descent. And there's a lot of tension. It's extremely controversial around those kind of claims for people who say, like, no, this is, like, a religion, and, like, we're, I don't know. It's definitely, I mean, she's definitely, like, walking into the middle of something, and I don't think that she probably understood what it was.
Yeah. And I think the reaction is just kind of like, don't do that. Make us deal with this sort of stuff. Whoopi, go away for a little bit. Like, that's basically what this was.
But there's some good stuff. I think Al Franken's, I was just looking up some stuff. Al Franken came out of the woodwork and said, you know, Whoopi is not anti-Semitic. She chose Goldberg for her last name, for her stage name.
Hell yeah, Franken. He's got the jokes.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, I think she's apologized. I can't imagine that. You can't cancel Whoopi, man. Yeah,
Comrade,
I think we can have the conversation and hear it out. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. Whoopi is like annoying. Like, you know, it's funny because I am feeling very defensive about her because we just did the based Whoopi.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I feel like, I mean, that's why Whoopi is fun though, is because she's like, she's working through a lot of these things. I think that she has, like, some pretty decent perspectives. I think that sometimes she's a bit sloppy. It's funny to go from talking about how wonderful East Germany was to then saying that you don't understand why Bernie Sanders doesn't talk about poverty. She said in 2020, which was something else. So I'm just saying, like, somebody who has that kind of track record, I wouldn't sort of hold things, that she's saying on that level to, like, have, like, extreme malicious intent. And rather, I think from anything, I think she was just trying to be like, you know, we need to come together as, like, a people. Right. But I can obviously understand. I mean, I think the bigger problem is that it's going on in this period of time, when so many people in the United States, like, use the Holocaust metaphor so flippantly, in a way that really takes away the power and the horror of his like historical experience. You know, like people, and that's like the big criticism of people who say, well, you know, vaccine mandates are like the Holocaust or something like that. Is that, you know, saying something like that is extremely diminishing to the genocide and terror that millions of people went through, right? And I think that's like a very, very valid conversation that I think people should be reminded of.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, before we get to any more voicemails, let's do a little bit. Joe Manchin's been doing a great job, and more people are recognizing it. Mm-hmm. We have first a clip.
The Real America.
A clip that to me looked, on the face of it, looked a lot like a documentation of child abuse. Further inspection showed that it was actually conservative parents decided to like bring their kids to a library and get, you know, you know, a smarmy Ben Shapiro lecture. But anyway, I thought this part was interesting because I think Ben Shapiro has a little bit more integrity in a certain kind of way than like say other conservatives who aren't willing to come out and say like, yeah, I'm against like infrastructure spending or like let's just say like I support Joe Manchin is like I think something that Crowder wouldn't want to do in certain cases, right? Like because you're trying to appeal to an audience of younger people, probably not all rich, right? Like that don't have this ingrained right wing ideology. And I think it's just interesting to note when it comes out and people are actually willing to own the things that they believe. So here's just Ben Shapiro talking to a bunch of children and ask who his favorite Democrat is.
About it.
Who is your favorite Democrat?
Wow, that is a difficult question.
I know, right?
A Democrat who's alive?
We find
right now, Joe Manchin, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, is my current favorite Democrat. He's preventing Joe Biden from doing a lot of bad things.
Do you think we can have a...
Yeah, so... Again, interesting, just willing to own that.
You can't put your children through that, man.
That's what I'm saying. It seems like, damn. I mean, I remember when conservatives were having an absolute conniption because some drag queens were reading books at libraries. I feel that outraged about this, that they felt about the drag queens. And I got this other clip too. Where's my Madison Cawthorn? 1 second. So this is a couple other guys.
Recently single, y'all.
Yeah, that's right.
So any brave folks in North Carolina.
So this kid, recently single, freak of a loser. And Blake Masters. Sorry, I mean, I just don't.
He's a wordsmith. Cawthorn over here, y'all.
He's beyond the pale. Blake Masters, who you know, some people putting forward, like maybe there's some sort of some primaries going on in the Republicans that are going to stand up for working people. Blake Masters doing an ad saying, you know, it used to be the case where you could raise a family on one income, and we need to get back to those days. And the question of how you do that, and it's like we do more capitalism harder. Anyway, here's Blake and Cawthorn talking about having a similar conversation.
We see some of the amnesty in the Build Back Better bill, which hopefully is failing.
Hopefully, I mean, I have never prayed for a Democratic senator so much in my life, but Joe Manchin is the man.
Not in the habit of praising Democrats, but yeah, actually, thank goodness for him, right?
I even hesitate to call him a Democrat. I mean, he's a lot like in the same vein as Rand Paul, just a statesman, just serves his constituents well.
Well, I think every...
It's so fascinating to me how they think of that. One, Blake Masters creeps me out. Like, I think it's actually like, I don't like say anything about the Democrat, but he's doing a lot. Like that the weird Silicon Valley, like, actually we hope to have a new bid out in August. And I don't know. I don't really have a whole lot to say about that. I just want to note this pattern because I don't think it's like we have bipartisanship. And it's bipartisan. There's a bipartisan consensus against working people in this country, mm-hmm. and that's what these people are all working towards. There's nothing new coming. I appreciate Josh Hawley saying that we should back off on NATO, but like he's not fundamentally. That's just the Rand Paul, Ron Paul shit, right? You can occasionally take a stand on foreign policy that you know not doesn't mean shit to you know fundraise and get emails, but. That none of these folks are actually good, like want to deliver for working folks.
I mean, and certainly not Joe Manchin. I mean, somebody who has committed their life now, you know, not just in recent, like, you know, there's so much zooming in of him, you know, in his current role. But, you know, this has been somebody who has been a pretty consistent no vote on any kind of expansion on protections for working people, on any kind of protection for like coal workers in a material sense. Like, he loves to talk about coal workers when he's talking about the profits of coal companies and coal owners. But when it comes to actually making sure that those people are able to fend for themselves, those people will have a future that's not under threat, one, by, you know, a switch off of fossil fuels, but two, from the massive amounts of assault that working people, particularly union labor, has experienced in the past 50 years, right? Like, Joe Manchin is, you know, he's consistent, like Bernie, except that he's like an absolute monster.
Yeah, I mean, just to pair, like, and it's going to be fascinating to me how Democrats try to run as if he's not a part of their party and, like, doing this exact same shit they want to run against Republicans. Because there's this clip here that was, you know, him just saying it, right? You know, and, like, he just admitted that I think you should leave clip. Here is a Manchin. We're just talking about Build Back Better and the reconciliation, right? Like,
means testing means that are we targeting the people that need it or getting it, or the people getting it that maybe could do without? I mean, they're in pretty good shape. So I said means testing. I said work requirements. Those are all very, very important in these things. And that way you target children. So you have the beginning of life, our children. Pre-K, yes. Then you have the end, where our senior citizens want to live in a dignity and respect of their own home. We can do that with some assistance. And again, some can pay a little bit, and some can't pay any. That's means testing. It goes an awful long way that way. I'm just not, so you know, I cannot accept our economy or basically our society moving towards an entitlement mentality, that you're entitled, okay? I'm more of a rewarding, because I can help those who really need help, if those who can help themselves do.
Yeah, so that type of, that message about entitlement there, like, that should, a party that actually gave a fuck about folks would rebuke that severely. Biden doesn't have the appetite for that, because they're still trying, I guess, to, like, squeeze something from that stone. But here, like, I saw this this Ron Johnson clip, and like, the sort of, like, normal Democrat campaign organs tweeting this out as if, you know, I take exception to this very severely, but, like, you have to be able to, like, walk the walk to a certain extent, or people, like, don't give a shit.
People decide to have families and become parents. That's something, you know, they need to consider when they make that choice. I've never really felt it was society's responsibility to take care of other people's children. People decide.
I mean, so, like,
oh boy,
right? Like, so
that's scummy as hell.
A slightly harder edged version of what Manchin was saying, though, right? Like, it's easy to say we're means testing it, right? But yeah, I don't know. That Ron Johnson's horrible, and, like, they, like, that's the thing is, like, it's I don't know. It'd be nice to have a political system that could actually take the amount of offense to something like that it needs to be taken.
Absolutely. I mean, again, like, you know, there's a lot of ideology in those kind of statements. I mean, Johnson and Manchin are two people. You want to talk about entitlement. These people who rely not out of the force of their own strength and personality, but they rely on the state and the system to put people in a position where people like Manchin and Johnson can extract value from them, right? They own things, like Manchin in particular owns these mines out there in West Virginia, again, protected by the state and by the government, by the system in general, to take advantage of the people who are actually in there working. Those are the people, you know, with the kind of can-do attitude. Manchin is somebody who sits behind pieces of paper and when things get rough, a police officer to be able to take all the shit from people that other people have created, right? Just don't get, like, I can't deal with the entitlement argument for people like that, who literally they sit on entitlements that they are taking from other people, right?
Yeah.
You know, the threat
entitlements to, like, returns on fucking EpiPens.
The threat to your pocket at the end of the day is not somebody trying to make sure that their child has baby formula. It's your boss, right? It's your boss who takes way more out of your paycheck and out of the profit that you create for the company than they take way more than you get back, right? I mean, that's the way that this entire system functions. So it's just rich to hear them go on about that. And not to make the argument that most people are familiar with, but like, it's always amazing too to hear people like Johnson talk about how, you know, having a family is a choice, but then spend all of their time standing against abortion rights and free contraceptives contraception for folks who need it.
Yeah. Want to do a few more voicemails? Then
yeah, let's do it.
So here's another one here.
Hello. Hey, David. Hey, Matt. I was just wondering, since you guys are having an episode on the economy, that you guys could touch on maybe not so much NFTs and crypto, but maybe have a minute to talk about like the actual economy and I'm not ready for this. Should have wrote something down. You guys.
I guess I'll keep playing it. He's still gonna go there. I was gonna
just delete this or keep it from being here.
Right. We should like maybe get Wolf back on, talk some economy.
And there's a lot to talk about. I mean, if you didn't catch it, we did a long segment on inflation recently that I think is important now because, you know, the Fed has signaled that rate increases are coming, which do mean that there's going to be a lot of discipline. The term they use is discipline in the market. And what that means is people are going to be holding on to their money a lot more than they already are, which is not good for the vast majority of people. But no, that's a good call. Happy to do it. Yeah, it would be fun to get Wolf on again.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. I have a friend who would vote for a Democrat if they, quote, were not out from the guns. He's a libertarian and actively decides not to think about the implications of the libertarian platform, viewing them as the last choice we have. We want a great society while keeping my guns because of my freedom. It goes without saying that the squad are like the worst kind of Dems to him. My question is, since he's convinced that, one, the Dems will take away his guns, and two, without guns, the country will fall into a dictatorship or worse, is how would you reason with him? What facts would play into your reasoning? Thanks for the show, and I'm happy to be the patron.
I mean, I don't support Democrats.
Beto. I mean, I'm just saying, like, you got a little Beto out here just being a complete pain in everyone's ass, getting, you know, pink in the cheeks, talking about he's going to come for everybody's guns. I mean, I'll just say, like, I would probably disagree with your friend, I think, to the extent of it. And for example, like, I could never imagine myself thinking that this is the most important issue or like the number one step between freedom and like authoritarianism is having a pistol in the household. But I don't share the Democratic Party's fixation on this. And I'll tell you that this is a great example of tension between the Democratic Party, which, you know, ostensibly tries to represent, you know, the popular masses in society, but functionally only represents a very small kind of, you know, political and social class. And look, you know, I don't think that people need to participate in gun ownership or anything like that. Matt and I, we haven't done like an official episode, but we've talked, I think, at length at this point about some of the reasons that, at least I'll speak for myself, why I oppose, you know, any kind of mass gun confiscation program or anything like that. But I think that this is the tension. Like, what you're dealing with your friend here, though, is, I, at least from my perspective, maybe Matt has a different one. This is one of the difficult aspects, I think, with the entire like strategy of like running democratic socialism within the Democratic Party, right? Because you have to deal with the Democratic Party brand. And first of all, I'll tell you one thing, the Democratic Party, I'll put your friend's fears at ease. The Democratic Party will never touch guns. Yeah. Not only because I think that they were like the kind of outrage that would happen about it, but this is like an incredible cash cow for the party.
That's what it is. It's a fundraising issue for them.
And the thing that's so annoying about it is because they don't want to address it in general, they come up with these kind of very, very like what they call like common sense solutions. And some of them make more sense than others. But a lot of these are sort of written in a way that makes like an illegal weapon versus a legal weapon kind of, you know, very fuzzy in ways that can be sort of goofy if you actually like know a thing or two about weapons. So anyway, like my point is like to your friend, I wouldn't be worried about the Democratic Party actually coming for weapons. And to you, I mean, this is the kind of difficult tightrope that we have to walk, you know, when people associate what we're trying to do with Beto and like all these other people out there. I would suggest, you know, fixating on the issues that work for people. I mean, if you knock on doors, if you do any kind of canvassing, you know what they tell you to do? They say, ask people what issues are most important to them. And if you find what the issues to your friend are most important, I'm sure that you can show how a democratic socialist, you know, future or perspective is going to touch on those, right? And if you don't want to, for example, make an argument about guns like I would, you know, find out what the other things are that they care about, right? Like the point is that like, you know, there is no one silver bullet for these things, but actually actively like saying, what are you interested in? What worries you? And saying, okay, well, we have things about like, there are things here that we think are, you know, that like are in our program that'll be beneficial to you.
Yeah. And it's not so easy because in certain districts, you're going to, if you like politically active, like Paul Prescott, right? They have gun concerns in that district. And like, you will need to be able to talk but the problem is like, this is in the context of an insane carceral system that we know who it victimizes, right?
Oh yeah.
And so like
already the people who are the victims of gun laws are poor and black people, by
exactly, yeah. Right. And so and that's the thing that like the Bloomberg class of Democratic donors don't really understand. And it's like, it's a tough thing because it's also not something that is told to folks in the wake of tragedies that those solutions might lead to that too, right? Like there's a lot deeper things going on in the psyche of America, but I think as far as priorities go, rounding up guns is not mine. Uno Mas, then I have to take a quick bathroom break, but I'll be able to hear you if you read some voicemails. Okay. Let's see, which one have we not seen here yet? Okay, here's one more. Oh, that's the same one. Sorry. I happen to recognize these by the numbers. Okay, here we go.
Hi, Matt and David. This is Dylan from Australia. I just started a new job, and I just thought I'd ask, what's the least professional thing that you've ever done in a workplace setting? Outside of, obviously, Matt, I imagine being stoned a lot. I hope everything is going well, and yeah, take care.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even consider that unprofessional, frankly, but least professional thing. Okay, here's an honest admission for the post game, folks. When we were, I might have said this before, but when we were during the pandemic, when we were broadcasting Majority Report from home, I used to have my gaming laptop open and I was playing Hades pretty much during all of the guest interviews. I was kicking some ass on Hades. That's pretty unprofessional. I'm trying to think of other jobs. McDonald's, I probably did some unprofessional shit, like, but nothing that really comes to mind. Yeah, what do you got?
So in college, I worked for John Delaney, who was one of the guys.
I always forget about this.
I mean, it was one of those things where, like, I was pretty broke, and there's somebody like walk around campus, like, you want a, you know, a politics job? I was like, yeah, that sounds interesting. They're like, we're paying $15 an hour, which to me was like, holy moly, that's a lot of money.
To do politics?
To do politics, and did not realize what they were paying you for was doing canvassing. So I did political canvassing, and I did it about five times, and they were like actual, like, not like the nice canvassing we do when we like volunteer our time. It's like 8 to 9 hour days with like people who had just been doing it from like campaign to campaign. And I don't know. I mean, in a normal experience, like you treat them as heroes, but there's something really sad about like doing it for like one of the most, someone who just becomes like a horrible corporate Dem. Like there's a scandal about him when he was running that yeah. was like John Delaney's a loan shark, right? Which right. he effectively was. anyways, I didn't give a shit. I was like I was a socialist at that point anyway, but I was just like, I need to get some politics experience. So like,
I did it
earnestly the first couple of days, and then they let me do it on my own. And I just started realizing like, well, the vast majority of people who you talk to, they shut the door in your face and you walk away and you get no information from it. And then every once in a while, somebody might be like somewhat interested. Anyways, you're logging like their response to it.
Right.
I could see what a normal, once I knew what a normal sheet looked like, I just started filling them in. and I would go and I would just go to Starbucks or like mess around for like 8 hours and I'd collect.
That's awesome.
But there was one, I would sometimes like do a little bit, like maybe like 30 minutes or something like that. Just on like the beginning and like the end of it, just in case, because you would get picked up too by one of the campaign people, just in case, you know, so somebody could see that like I was on the trail. One day I got 7 volunteers like in a row, which was huge numbers. And I was like at the top of the board for the entire campaign, actually, having the highest like recruiting average for like report. And like literally I knocked on 10 doors and 7 of them just were like, we want to volunteer for Delaney, which is ridiculous.
What anyways, the fuck was going on there? That's something.
They were like teachers and stuff too. Like it wasn't a rich neighborhood. It was sort of like, you know. Anyway,
the Delaniacs. So
that was probably the worst thing that I ever did. I mean, in kinds of unethical ways that I was just like filling out a sheet of paper and like doing college homework, and going home. I only lasted about 2 weeks because it was such a pain in the ass.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I've never done any fraud on the job before.
The other unprofessional thing I did, it was like my first like kind of like, you know, tie job in DC. Or not my first, I guess, but my last job before I moved to New York and met Michael and did all this. But I worked at this organization, which is a pretty decent organization, but you know, it was just boring. And we'd like worked in a tall building downtown DC, and I had my own office, and right across from my office was another firm. Who knows what it was? But I just felt so alienated from these people. I'd see them every single, you know, it was like one of those realizations, like I see this guy every single day and he's looking out his window at me. I turn my desk around cause I just couldn't look out that window at him all day, but I'd just seen this person every day for, you know, a couple years. And I was like, well, you know, this is my last day. I'll never see this person again. And like, I feel like I need to communicate something with them, but I didn't want to do any kind of like sappy thing. Like, you know, farewell or something like that. I just looked over at him and I just like put 2 middle fingers up and just like kept him up. And he was like, what, you know, he's like very confused. I just kept on like flicking him and then I walked out of the building and, you know, never was heard from again.
That is so funny. I'm trying to think of like what director's films that reminds me of.
Werner Herzog does something. There's like a good clip of Werner Herzog, talking about doing this at some like film festival where they tell him, it's like, you're not supposed to like be in your movie. Right. And Werner Herzog's like, no, we're supposed to feel and be a part of it. Happy New Year's, you fucking losers. And like walks off stage. but that's way cooler than what I did.
I mean, it is a little, I feel like Edward Norton in a calmer, version of Fight Club would do something like that.
Yeah, that's basically what it was.
Last voicemail from a Joe Snuffy here, and then we can do some of those messages. Okay. Here's Joe.
Hello, this is
Joe. Oh, excellent. Pause right
away. Joe Snuffy, trying this again because I think the call dropped. But a guy I know who I've worked on his city council runs in the past, Alexander Kittis, he declared his candidacy for a state rep seat in Rhode Island. He's a really awesome guy. He's the one that I look to for if he tells me that in something, you know, he needs people to work on something, I drop what I'm doing to go and help out. He's a Rhode Island political cooperative candidate. You guys have expressed some interest in them in the past. I think that it's an exportable model that could help us to actually challenge and defeat the corrupt incumbents from the Democratic Party nationwide. And I would love to set you up, you know, if you guys are interested in talking with them. I think he'd be a great person to be able to talk about what the co-op's actually been doing and, yeah, see if we can spread the knowledge, spread the methods. Yeah, I'll keep you guys informed on any cool new stuff going on with it. And that's all I got.
Appreciate it, Joe. It's an interesting context up there. I mean, it's a very different kind of system than what I'm familiar with. I mean, the political machine, I mean, in Rhode Island, I guess New York was sort of like that too. I mean, I'd be interested in learning more. I mean, we're trying to figure out how we want to do candidate stuff. We're doing another interview with the Austin DSA people, and that's like, I don't know, I'm a member, and I think it's worthwhile to get those things out. But I'm definitely interested in learning more for sure. Absolutely. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I also want to take the chance to shout out, if we got any Texas, Dallas-based listeners, particularly Chris Liel, my buddy, running in Texas 114th, has gotten Our Revolution, AFL-CIO, and the AFT nice. Endorsement. So, interesting. It's interesting to see how Chris is doing it, because he's got some press in the Dallas Morning News, and it's his pitch of, you know, the last time the Democrats were worth a shit was when Texan progressives were leading it, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting pitch to see that, you know, filter its way through, like,
you know, it's crazy response. Like how people don't know like how influential like a lot of Texas congressmen were in the in the New Deal. Yeah, no, that's cool. I mean, I've been enjoying Chris's campaign a lot, and like he's a teacher too, so it's really sweet to see him. Like, I don't know, he was posting the other day about going back to his classroom,
the students, yeah,
and hearing from the students again. It was pretty nice.
Got some, and
I don't have takes on this yet. We're waiting. I mean, just we got some really disappointing news about Greg Kassar yesterday, so we're waiting to see how Austin DC is going to handle that. I mean, Greg, I mean, I still say like it's a vote yes, obviously, if you live in the district. I think organizationally there's a challenge now, because a letter surfaced of him saying a kind of private letter. So I'm curious about how and why it sort of came up now, but it came up with him basically saying he doesn't support BDS and all this kind of stuff, where he's basically not following the DSA line on Palestine.
And he wants to go like visit and like,
yeah, you know, I don't know. There's going to be a lot of discussions about it. I'm pretty gutted, and I think that we'll see what happens internally within the Austin DSA. I know people are immediately working on it, because they were as blindsided as everybody else. So hopefully, you know, there's a resolution there. But
yeah, go ahead.
I'm just saying, it's like this is the bit that's hard about doing, you know, local politics. As a socialist right now, because you get yourself into these kind of conundrums where it's like, well, obviously, you know, Greg represents, I think, a very progressive pro-working class kind of politics. But I think as a member of a socialist organization, you have to have that international solidarity. You can't be, a socialist except for Israel, right? You can't be a socialist except for you support apartheid. And, you know, sometimes there's a question of like people not being having difficulty with the kind of like delicate nature of some of these questions and the way that it's sort of put forward, particularly when there is like a rise of, for example, anti-Semitic violence in the United States. Some people think that, oh, well, that means I should support Israel, you know, which is not the solution. You know, it's also extremely problematic, by the way, too, to associate, you know, an entire religion with a nation state, too. So just putting that out there, I'm sure we'll get more information as it comes. I'm just happy to do it for patrons, because like there's a democratic process that's ongoing within the organization, and I'm a big supporter of that, as I was with Jamal Bowman's thing. So I think that I support that process, and I'm waiting to hear. I just want to say I'm not ignoring it. I just don't think that it's also helpful for somebody like me to like cannonball publicly and you know.
I don't like that. That's not, leave that to the people, leave it to the people who are more involved and close to the situation than me. But I mean, I do think generally it's a bad, you know, if that's the way he goes, it sucks. And yeah. I'll just say, like, not to, I guess, like, you know, apologize for it, but just to explain context, I've talked to like people who follow races across the country. Democratic majority for Israel is fucking.
Oh, they're throwing
all
down.
Over the country, all over the country, just like they did with Chantel Brown over Nina Turner. And there's, I think that's spooked a lot of the running for office class.
So I get that. I will just say the way that the race is going here. I mean, Greg got like all of the endorsements, you know, from AFL-CIO, like all the big ones. He's outraced his opponent by a lot. Like, if ever there was a place that, like,
right,
obviously, like, you're making calculations, but, like, if ever, like, first of all, like, you should not be cheap and make calculations when we're talking about people's lives in apartheid, right?
Right.
And secondly, like, if there was a situation and a scenario where, like, you might have the space to do it, it seems like in this race. Right. I don't want to jinx things, but, yeah. Anyway, we'll get more on that soon.
Yeah.
Should we do some Discord?
Let's do some Discord.
Oh, yeah, and we can't forget we have a brain genius as well.
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah, I'll get that queued up.
Edwin wants to know, he asked this to me, but to both you and I, about our thoughts on this Ukraine standoff. Well, there's certainly, you know, I mean, there's like the quick version and the long version. The quick version is the United States should back the fuck off. What the Biden administration is doing right now is absolutely frightening. The expansion of NATO that has gone on since, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union is a huge accelerant of this crisis. Is it the only factor? No. But it's the one that is like the most directly related to us right now. Beyond that, it's just like the way that it's covered in the United States has been pretty wild. When you have the Ukrainian government saying that, like, it's not helpful, the kind of hysteria that they're getting from the Biden administration,
right.
You know, that might be a lesson to some folks that it might be time, you know, to back down. And, you know, I think that what's really worrying about the Ukraine crisis right now is that there has just been a like an absolute willingness in the American media, in particular, and specifically on like kind of like left liberal social media, to just like sprint ahead with the most ungrounded analysis of what's going on. I mean, the way that, you know, things are written about, you would think, you know, that like an invasion force is sitting there right now, primed, you know, to march over the border. And that, frankly, is just not the case. You know, and yeah, I mean, that's the quick and dirty of it, though. There's a pretty decent piece in Jacobin a couple of days ago. I can look up the title if people want it in depth. Piece that I thought was actually pretty even-handed in the sense of, like, because basically what people get mad about is they want you to sit here and be like, you know, is to like freak out and like go through like the laundry list of why Putin is bad and dangerous, which he absolutely is. Yes. But why does Putin exist? Putin exists because the American government basically tried to humiliate and destroy their rival in the Soviet Union after its collapse. And the United States interfered in elections. They promoted a kind of shock therapy, destructive marketization of an economy that only led to this massive oligarch class that we've seen. And what happens when you eradicate a social structure like the Soviet Union, like the Communist Party in a society, when the previous society was essentially like czarist and imperial? Well, of course, it returns to a kind of like provincial warlord kind of mentality that then gets coalesced later in the 90s by a character like Putin, who is basically able through his own power and strength and political savvy to get everybody in line with what he wants to do. And no doubt about it, Russia is a right-wing country. But again, this is something that's like created by this kind of imperial conflict. And so sitting around in the way that liberals want to talk about is like, oh, the villain who's just like come out of nowhere, Vladimir Putin, you know, to threaten global democracy, I think is a very unhelpful way to talk about these things. And, you know, just knowing the way that most the kind of ignorance that most people have of this kind of history of the past 30 years, I don't find it to be the most beneficial thing to front load a statement when you're saying that like NATO should end its expansionist like policies, right? To front load it with like a litany of focusing on Putin, because all that does is just work up the kind of pro-war forces, right? Because they won't get to the bottom when you say the NATO thing.
I mean, I saw this tweet that I thought I don't know if this. I saw some people follow this reporter that I think are cool, so maybe she's not bad. So I don't want to put her on blast in general. But this quote tweet. So the original tweet: Germany is blocking NATO ally Estonia from giving military support to Ukraine by refusing to issue permits for German origin weapons to be exported to Kyiv as a brace for a potential Russian invasion. And this tweet is it safe to say that Germany is complicit with Russia at this point? And it's like. My response to this is has been very much like, look, it's fucking Germany's deal, right? And like the NATO stuff seems like the priority for us.
Why does NATO exist?
Exactly.
After the Warsaw Pact ended, right?
Yeah. And so like Putin sucks, whatever. Like
this is the piece I'm just saying. I'm not saying it's the best and only piece, but it's probably the most even-handed if that's what people are also looking for. I thought that the DSA statement was great also, by the way.
I saw a lot of people pissed off about it, but yeah, I don't.
But again, the only people who were pissed off about it were freaks too, who had like or freaks or people who have no real connection. There's this one character, man. You know, we don't usually do this, but there's one character who keeps on there's too many tweets for me to go through. But there's this guy who's like a paper member, who is always doing like weird ass interference. Let me show you. Cause we're doing it. Why not? This is the thing that's so frustrating about DSA too. You know, as a member myself, is you have all these paper members who, like, I always make it very clear that I speak for myself. On these kind of things, but you have people who like come forward and they're like, I'm this or that. So DSA International Committee put out a very decent statement. DSAIC opposes U.S. brinkmanship in Ukraine, which only further escalates the crisis and calls for an end to NATO imperialist expansionism. We urge anti-war activists to oppose military escalations and demand a lasting diplomatic solution. No war with Russia. Again, and this is a very delicate situation, and it is amazing how many people try to like finally remember themselves as members of the anti-war movement when it's easy on reflection when there's no stakes in it, and how quickly in this moment are like, well, actually this time it's different because this time it's about democracy. I'll tell you right now, that is a huge mistake to be doing that. And somebody asked in the chat, I just noticed, was a paper member. I mean, what that means is like somebody who's like, they are a member of the organization in the sense that they signed the piece of paper and they paid dues.
Wasn't there a famous example of someone being like, I'm a DSA member and I support like Israel or something like that, right?
Well, plenty of that. I mean, it happens all the time. like that tech lady was doing it, right? And this was another one. I usually don't dunk. Or like, I don't do this right. To like send people out. I just don't find that be helpful, but it is worth noting it. Cause like, I think what frustrates me about it is like, there's like this kind of rift that I've been sort of hoping to work through between like, I know a group of people who consider themselves to be like true radicals and communists. And they think the DSA is like an organization that is meant to shepherd people in the Democratic Party, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't find that to be reflective of the vast majority of DSA folks, nor do I find that to be the purpose of that organization. You know, that is the space where socialist politics are happening. But people like this frustrate me because they pop up out of nowhere and everyone's like, who the hell is this guy freaking out about stuff? And then, you know, it only feeds the fire of the kind of conspiratorial people, right? Like, oh, see, DSA actually is, pro-war. But he goes, I agree with everyone posting how bad this take is, but luckily DSA's elected officials have a far wiser POV than this. And our electeds have actual votes in Congress, whereas the DSA power ends after an 8,000 follower Twitter account. Let me see. Yeah, it's and this guy's like been popping up all over. And I don't want to like spend too much time scrolling through tweets. But the point is that if you're a member of a Democratic organization sitting around and saying like, well, I'm very happy that, you know, the membership of our organization doesn't have much of a say in things and that we have people who aren't listening on these questions gives me solace. I mean, you probably aren't somebody who believes in concepts, for example, like democratic socialism, which is about building people power consensus. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, what's the next one? Sorry, that's the first one. We're going to move on to folks who haven't asked questions, if that's okay. Louise Anarchist, which is a name I love very much, who says, I've been participating in the Institute for Christian Socialism's political partner education, and I feel like it's really bringing folks together. I was wondering if you'd ever have the folks from the Magnificast on to talk about Christianity and its relationship to socialism. I feel like there's probably a good number of us who are trying to take the meaning of faith back from the right wing. I'm not familiar with that podcast, but I commend your work, and yeah, I'd be interested in hearing more. I love those traditions.
I would be interested in that too. I'm actually reading the Bible. I'm up to. I have this version of it that has full audio.
The Hunter's Bible, I know.
Hollywood production.
Oh, so everybody has like a different voice. In the days
of Josiah, the son of Ammon. Wait, that's too fast. Hold on, let me slow down. I'm also listening to it sped up. I mean, I don't got 80 hours.
I will consume the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea.
But I'm gonna like it's. I mean, I'm familiar with some of the stories that being raised Catholic, but it's interesting just to like go through a text that is so fucking foundational and so referenced, and actually just get it and know where things go. Like I'm gonna do that with. I'm also going for the Quran after that. So
Matt's gonna pull a Cat Stevens.
Gonna know it all of it. Yeah. Oh damn! I should get a good Islamic name.
Mateus. I don't know if that's the song. JB Funk says, for a conversation about AIM, American Indian Movement, Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. I skipped dinner, so I'm losing it a little bit. Please bring on David Trier. His take in the heartbeat of Wounded Knee is interesting, and I'd be curious to learn more about his take on AIM. Oh, that'd be really fun.
Yeah, true.
Spencer in Utah says, Matt, I see that you liked a tweet from Adam Neely concerning his music getting NFT minted fraudulently. Do you follow him and check out his other takes? He has several videos on the intersection of music and corporate law, as well as one music theory and racism that posterizes Ben Shapiro.
No, I am not familiar. Tag me on Twitter. I just saw the NFT tweet.
Boomay. I hope I'm getting that right. Matt and David, with all the Hitchens talk lately, thoughts on Parenti and Hitchens debate? I mean, Hitchens just gets completely decimated in that debate, and it's really shameful to watch. but it could be fun to do that again. Cause I mean, we didn't want to like downplay the Iraq war, but like that is like so dominant in the Hitchens discourse that we sort of
didn't. And people get it. And we don't really have a whole lot new to say like some of the, what led to it. And
if there was some like, oh, Hitchens might've been a little writer. No, he was just absolutely wrong. And monstrous, and asking why he went that way is interesting. Anyways, that could be fun though to revisit. Cause I do think sometimes reminding people about how horrible Iraq was and how at the time people knew too.
It wasn't. Yes. That's important.
Mala says, sports are incredibly influential in American culture, whether you enjoy them or not. There are Bill Simmons adjacent people that's primary content focuses on sports and pop culture, but they also use their platform to share their political views from time to time. You know, something that's funny. I noticed that a lot. And there's a longer question I'll get back to, but like, it is always funny when you, watch guys, who, are like right wing radio hosts and they're like, you know, I talk about Alabama football and politics, right? And it's just like, to me, I feel like thematically it's a little bit different to like jump through it. But I guess if you're doing a daily show, it can be helpful. And the right, I feel like, is a lot more comfortable doing that. Though, check out Woz.
But Woz is very adjacent to Bill Simmons.
There's a longer question.
That's my political education, though. KFAN was sports, Minnesota sports, and liberal talk radio.
That's pretty unique, man. I don't think I've heard that combo before.
Yeah.
I think those Bill Simmons adjacent guys are genuinely well-intentioned and might not call themselves socialists, but would agree with most every policy if you took them down a list of socialist policies. I think you can build a credibility and trust with a loyal base of readers and listeners. There are certain people's basketball opinions that I will defer to and trust more than I trust my own judgment. If I wasn't already a Majority Report TMBS LR listener for many years, I would hear Matt picking LaMelo Ball as his most fun player to watch right now and giving his reasoning and completely agree. Then I might go check out his other content, already having built a trust and credibility and judgment. And that's why I think the left needs a subversively political sports podcast. And to be honest, I haven't seen the first half yet, because Ja Morant is the second most fun player to watch right now, and he was having a huge game tonight. Go Bulls.
I mean, the right is, this is Andrew Breitbart's philosophy, was politics is downstream of culture.
Oh, yeah.
I think participating in those, I think you're right. Like, I think that's how people do find, they see little glimmers of like political education in folks like that who are, and sports allows like individuality sometimes for people to express stuff like that. But I think the right is more serious about that. I agree.
I mean, I also think there's like more comfort in, like, I know plenty of people who are sports journalists and sports writers, including people who listen to the show. And you know, I interact with too, who are lefties. So it's not that these spaces are like, you know, people who do it for a living only think one thing. In fact, you know, I think a lot of people might be a little surprised if they think that it's dominated one way or the other. I think the bigger problem is people who really get into politics, particularly in the left, have such a subculture, counterculture thing,
yeah,
that they have a difficult time breaking out into mass culture. I mean, like, and I don't mean this as any shade to anybody out there, but like, I've seen some like left wing attempts at doing like a sports show, you know, but it's so like to the people who are already consuming this stuff that it might not have that cross appeal.
Right.
And I mean, it's the same thing with music. Like, we were talking about that the other day. It's like, I don't really appreciate, or I should say, that sounds so mean. I don't get really stoked on like people who are like, I'm going to make really explicitly left-wing country music. Right. And it ends up just being like you sounding like slogans on like a kind of fairly generic, you know, guitar track. Right. And like, that's really boring to me, versus a band like Croy and the Boys, which is like a great local band around here, which makes incredible music. It's good country music. I just saw them recently in a packed, you know, stage. You know, everyone was going absolutely insane. And like the messages of those songs is like not just like hard work and like we like working people, but it was about class, it was about gentrification, and all of these things that people felt, and was presented in a very genuine way that like we all like, because we like that culture and that music here. I guess what I'm saying is like, that is a really, that's an effective way to do politics and art, right? Versus like, I don't know, like something that's like too heavy handed. Everybody doesn't like it. When things are too heavy handed, you always distrust people, because you feel like, what are they trying to convince me of?
Right. Yeah.
Well, that was, oh no, we had one more, and then let's do this, Lindsay, to close out.
All right. Yeah.
Obi Subprime says, Beto is a massive loser. That's it. No. who's going to be dumpstered in the general election. But I have to say, just driving from DFW to Beaumont yesterday, I'm honestly surprised at how many Republicans are running for governor against Abbott. Any idea what that means for the politics of Texas? Oh, yeah. It's I mean, it shows where the threat is to their power. It shows what Abbott's worried about, too,
yeah,
like where the focus is. I mean, he's trying to shore up. I mean, there's a lady who's running against him. There's Alan West. I mean, he's just running a complete crackpot campaign that, like, Abbott's too soft and left wing. I mean, it does show that, you know, the GOP does consider the state to be a one party state, which is why they have a vibrant, you know, a very, very vibrant, Republican primary going on right now. Though I think Abbott's going to walk away with it. I don't find it to be like an, like he's not under threat, but I think it does show like an interesting development. There's the material thing. It's like you worry that Abbott's doing a lot of trying to shore up a kind of like extra reactionary base, which I think is very reasonable to see in his most recent actions. And, you know, just the propaganda videos that he's been putting out of him at the border surrounded by like armed police cars and stuff like that. I mean, that's obviously targeted at a certain person. But I think beyond that, it's like there's a kind of accept Beto. Nobody wants to run for governor on the Democratic Party because they have tarnished that like brand in most people's heads so much that most people don't want to go through the abuse of running for governor. And I'm not saying that because I have like too much sympathy with like rich folks who get tapped to run these kind of like quixotic like Democratic Party campaigns here. But like nobody wants to get the shit, you know, to have their entire family shit talked for, you know, a year. Have embarrassing details of their family life being like dug up to get 30% of the vote, right? Much rather like stay in your comfy position or continue practicing law somewhere and be respected in your community than becoming like a villain. And like, that's a real problem for the Democratic Party in Texas, is that they don't really have much of a bench. And, you know, Beto has been a really great cash cow. I think I'd like to do something on that campaign soon before the primary is over, but, yeah, no, it is pretty striking though how many right wingers are running big campaigns and raising money against Abbott.
Well, exactly. Fucking, it's a business now.
Well, it's a business. It also like it is worrying to see like people are like, we need to have an even stricter border policy, or like they run and they say like, I'm a real Republican running right against the socialist Abbott. And the funniest thing is that actually like there's a really great piece I put it out on my Twitter by Justin Miller in Texas Observer. You'll be able to find out very quickly on what has happened with Abbott under the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, he's gotten, he's drastically and dramatically increased the powers of the governor of Texas. And you know, people who aren't from here might not be familiar, but like the governor of Texas is what's called a weak governor system. So unlike a lot of other states where like that is effectively the executive, the power of the executive branch in Texas actually used to be very dispersed. And that started to change under Rick Perry, primarily through like patronage. But under Abbott, it's gotten even worse. One, because he inherited those networks, and two, because he's used the emergency powers after the disaster, the declaration of disaster in Texas because of the COVID-19 pandemic, to increase the powers of the governor's office, to decrease the powers of local and county governments across the state. So he has dramatically increased his power over the legislature. He's dramatically increased his power over city governments. He's dramatically increased his power over county governments. And he has coalesced power over the other functions of the executive branch that aren't officially a part of the governor position in a way that like he's completely remade the, you know, the position of Texas governor, which should worry people. And you know, if you are a true small government conservative, it should worry you. But of course, they're not worried about Abbott, you know, banning mask mandates or things like that. They're worried because he hasn't done even more, which is just pretty wild. So it's gonna be weird.
Yeah.
Well, we got Big Head. Yeah, let's do Big Head.
Set this up for me. I haven't seen this yet.
Well, I mean, this is just our friend here, deontologist. Breaking down, and who shared this, and I just thought it was too funny. This is James Lindsay explaining in this 15-second clip what he thinks the Marxist theory of a base versus superstructure is. I love it so much because he has all this confidence when he does these things, but he sort of, it seems like things are a little murky for him still. And he also thinks he's like the first person to uncover it, which right, I also like is I always find very funny too.
Their belief is that everything works in terms of, if we go back to Marx with the idea of a base that then has a superstructure that's risen above that, and the superstructure becomes self-perpetuating and designs how society is going to operate. Their belief is that,
you know, so the superstructure comes out of the base in Marxist theory, right? So you have the base, which is like the economic like conditions, right? And then the superstructure is the legal society, like the law, the kind of culture, the ideology that sort of comes out of it in general. And I don't know. It's always funny to hear James Lindsay sort of like
put it together,
put his little toe in there. And because this is something, by the way, that like the labor theory of value is like theories that are sort of being developed and kicked around in philosophy at that period of time, not just by Marx. And I think that's like, you know, Marx is working through concepts that are existing in other traditions.
Right. Well, but it gets really scary when he touches it. So,
yeah.
He's got such a weird affect that I can't quite put my finger on. It's like the guy in Men in Black that has the alien inside him. But like, it's like some sort of like, he looks worried every once in a while.
Oh, he looks really shifty. Oh, for yeah. Sure. I mean, it's like, I think there was a note. Damn, I think there was like a longer version of that clip, but it's okay if I can't find it. I don't know, man. I did a whole thing. If people didn't catch it, I did a whole thing with our friends over at What's Left of Philosophy podcast with Ben Burgess on this boy and also Jordan Peterson and a lot of these other right wingers. So go check that video out. They have a YouTube channel too, What's Left of Philosophy. You can find it. It's very good. Check out as well. If you're looking for more content there, you can get it.
Well, folks, what do we have coming up on this weekend? I think you got
Matt. We got a reading series for y'all. We'll announce stuff about that pretty soon. I'll be back tomorrow. I think 4 Central for a Griscom stream. I wanted to talk a little bit about local versus state power, particularly what's going on here, and hopefully my power will still be on. So we'll see y'all for that too.
Hi, folks. Thank you so much, patrons, for joining us one more time, and same time next week for the live show. I always do that.